Hi, Thomas. We are really delighted to have you as our guest today on the Big Unlock podcast. This is season 6 and we are about at 180 episodes. Our listeners love to hear from people who are at the forefront of AI, who are using AI, you know, with great success in their organizations. My name is Ritu M. Oberoi, and I'm the managing partner here at Big Rio and Demo Consulting, also a co-host of the Big Unlock podcast with Rohit. And with that, I'll hand it over to Rohit. And then after that, you can get started. Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, Thomas. As Ritu said, you know, very warm welcome to the podcast. We're looking forward to an exciting conversation. I'm Rohit Mahajan. I'm the CEO and managing partner at Big Rio and Demo Consulting. And over to you, Thomas, for your introductions.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be with you. I saw many of your episodes. It's, of course, a really great podcast. I'm very much looking forward to the conversation. I'm serving as the Chief AI Officer here at Eli Lilly and Company, which is, of course, a great place to actually develop AI and build medicines with AI and help the whole pharmaceutical value chain to get more medicines to patients out there. My background is in AI. I have a PhD in machine learning from a time when it was not cool yet, a long, long time ago, and then spent nearly my whole career in AI in healthcare at large systems like Memorial Sloan Kettering and Mount Sinai. I had a lot of students and founded three startups, of which some even got FDA approval for AI in healthcare. So really excited to be with you.
Wow. Our listeners always love the origin story. So what pulled you to healthcare specifically, Thomas? I know you said you were in machine learning, but then why did you choose to go into, you know, healthcare? Because that always uncovers like some very good journey, if I may say so.
Yeah, very good question. So I guess as a kid, my father took me to a rescreening of 2001, A Space Odyssey. And then I wanted to build AI after that, of course, right? Like HAL 9000, but a good one. And then when I did my master thesis, I had a colleague who actually trained back then even a neural network to differentiate cancer from non-cancer. And I was completely surprised that it is even possible. So that was really flabbergasting that you can do that with code, right? And really help patients. And then that took over 20 years until you get that actually into the clinic. But being able to help people by writing code is something amazing. And that got me hooked. And that's why I spent all my career and energy in machine learning and healthcare.
Great answer. Thank you so much. Rohit, would you like to ask the next question?
Yeah, what I was hoping, Thomas, that you have a unique perspective having worked in startups and having become familiar with AI before, I think, the ChatGPT movement, as we all call it, where AI has got democratized and it's like in the within the reach of everybody. So please tell us a little bit more about, you know, what you're looking at in terms of your role at Lilly and, you know, what kind of initiatives you are focusing on. We would love to learn more about that. What are some of the things that you're setting out to do?
So Lilly is a fascinating place because in contrast to many of the startups or other places, the breadth of application of AI is quite enormous. So we use AI in drug discovery, of course, for small molecules, large molecules, in genetic medicines. We use it in development. We use large language models to help with drafts for regulatory agencies or answering questions. We use language models for improving workflow in all kinds of the organizations. But then there's this huge space, of course, of manufacturing. So Lilly is on the largest manufacturing build out the world has ever seen. So there's a lot you can do with AI and digital twins at various granularity to help to produce medicines better and faster. And then we also use time-based models, for example, in financial forecasting for profit centers, P&L and so forth. And then on the commercial side, we also use AI to help our sales force in contacting HCPs and planning their routes and whatnot. So it's very, very diverse throughout Lilly where you can apply AI. And we have a central registry where we log and track all the AI projects within Lilly. And there we currently have over 1,000 different projects in all these different areas. And that makes it a very interesting and diverse job, of course.
So great answer, Thomas. That leads us into the next question where we are seeing this. So like last year when we were at, HIMSS or any of the other conferences, the main keyword was human in the loop. AI is here to augment, not automate. So there was a clear distinction that this is going to be a tool that's going to help you in your work or, make you do things in a better or easier or faster way. But now with the rise of agentic AI and frameworks, we are seeing like complete autonomy. Now the talk of human in the loop is kind of, taking a backseat, and you're saying that these agents can autonomously accomplish a lot of work. But with that, then obviously comes the trust factor. So since you said the range of applications is so broad across Lily, how do you see that? How are you evangelizing AI to Lily to help pathologists, physicians, data scientists, and all the other people trust the AI and make sure that it's there to help them in their work and augment human capabilities?
Yeah, very, very good question. And of course, a very broad one. First of all, I think it helps to actually ground the conversation a little bit. Of course, these AI models are all fabulous machine learning models and help us in a tremendous way. But yes, there's also no magic behind it, right? These models don't have a will or volition, or they're not going to run off and destroy our civilization. And regarding the agentic, so we use agentic approaches in many of our areas. We use agentic orchestration, for example, in lab-in-the-loop scenarios or in complicated submission systems and so forth. But very often, of course, the heavy lifting is not done by the language models that are used to orchestrate everything, but very dedicated models, for example, diffusion model for de novo design of molecules, or all kinds of temporal models that we use on the financial side and so forth. So there's a lot of AI, of course, outside of language. That's very important, right? But the orchestration is often done in a agentic way, and the LLMs, of course, allow us to have an interface to all of these. Mm-hmm. Regarding trust, you're of course spot on. So in organizations like ours, and actually a very successful one, which sometimes makes it more difficult to have that organizational change management in between, you have to convince, of course, colleagues to use new tools and change what they did in the past. That, of course, only works if you are really deep in the trenches with the various areas where you apply it, you co-develop with them from the beginning, you solve real business problems or real scientific problems, and then make sure you can actually integrate them into their workflow. What never works, didn't work in healthcare in general or in a startup, it doesn't work at Lily. If you develop something often very, very cool and functional outside and then try to throw it over the fence in the application area, that always fails, right? You have to really do that together. And that also then builds that trust. And then you have to have, of course, complete transparency. You have to be very clear in stating the goals, what these things can do and cannot do. Of course, people fall into one or the other camp where they think AI is magic, it's going to do everything, take over everything, or they fall into a very pessimistic camp and think, oh, it's hallucinating or confabulating and it doesn't work at all. If you're very clear that these very large and powerful statistical models can help many, many of your processes and accelerate what we do and get medicines out faster for patients, then you can build that trust that really helps to also field these AI systems in our daily practice.
Okay, that's a great answer. I think I really agree with you there, because that's what we heard at the other conferences as well, that it can never be a top-down kind of, diktat. It has to be a buy-in from everybody in the company, and people have to feel involved. And that's how they feel that they're participating, and that makes them more open to, being in the change management. Mm-hmm. So with that being said, Thomas, if you can give us like maybe one or two real world examples of success stories at Lily where you've had great success with your approach to AI, or some demonstrated projects that really brought people on board and showed the power of AI, I think our listeners would love to hear more about that.
Oh, of course, yes. There are, of course, very many. So in the language space, for example, our software product engineering team built something fabulous called Cortex. And on top of that, there's something called Chat in the Box. So these are REC systems, or now CAG systems, any employee could actually use for their area. So if you have hundreds of PDFs or thousands of PDFs in your area, you can index it, throw it in there, build your own chatbot. So we have hundreds of very specialized APIs, chatbots in the language areas people are using constantly. And then, of course, we have much larger advanced systems with a lot of guardrails when it comes to communications with regulatory agencies, drafting documents, and so forth. Outside of language, we have a large initiative in discovery. And that's, as I said, large molecules, small ones, nucleotide language models for genetic medicines. And for some of our targets, some of the leading molecules were already co-designed with AI. We build from scratch here at Lilly. So we do build our own foundation models. At Lilly, we have that enormous luxury that we have a wealth of data over many, many decades. Lilly is 150 years old, and reaction data from two decades alone is, of course, a huge wealth where you can help to build models, property prediction models, de novo design models for these different areas. And they compare very, very well with all kinds of other approaches in that space. And that's very motivating for the team to, of course, drive that forward. On the other end of the spectrum, in the computer vision space, we use vision transformer models or other image-based models, for example, in quality control in manufacturing, that allowed us to increase throughput at the lines for injectors for millions of vials. So there you have immediate impact with AI and computer vision. We also use it to build more biomarkers. This is the space where I come from, for example, in pathology, to find cancer, classify cancer. I also do that in the preclinical space to assess disease or reaction to medication in all kinds of preclinical models, or then afterwards in radiology, if you want to, for example, track disease. So very exciting areas with concrete implications at that, at Lilly itself.
Yeah, thank you for sharing some of those examples with us. It's very interesting. And when you say that, you know, you have data from 150 years, that's where usually most companies get stuck because, you know, that data is either isolated or not in a shape or form to be, you know, used. So that data scrubbing or data labeling, you know, that itself becomes like a huge project. So did you at Lilly feel the same way, or was the data already in a good enough, you know, shape or form to be used for inputs into your AI systems?
Yeah, of course, that's always a moving target for every large organization. But I was surprised how well in shape the data infrastructure actually was when I joined Lilly. It's quite amazing. But it is, of course, a moving target. Lilly brings on dozens of new devices every single day, every lab that goes online and so forth, right? You constantly have new data coming in, new data streaming in, new old data sources being opened up. So AI allows us to take advantage of data we couldn't take of advantage of some years back, be it unstructured text data or image data and so forth. So it is a constant moving target. And as you know, in machine learning, 80% of your work is always data work, and then 20% is machine learning on top. So that does not change at Lilly. It's like at a startup or in academia as well. What is very unique here is that we can also produce a lot of data. So we have various initiatives where we build lab in the loop setups where we can produce huge amounts of data we can then use to train models at the scale I haven't seen before. So that is very exciting, but it's also necessary. So you can really compare it to the self-driving car industry where you need your models to produce much, much more data than you could probably collect in the real world. And so that combination of synthetic data and real world data really gives us the amount of data that really facilitates the training of these frontier models internally, which we then can use to design molecules or do all kinds of predictions.
That's really a very good insight, because I remember hearing about Waabi, who, you know, are doing self-driving trucks, and they said there's just not enough training data in the world to train those trucks. So they actually had to simulate like an entire universe and use synthetic training data to train the self-driving trucks. And those trucks are now driving on the roads of Houston. And it's really interesting to see how they've been trained on synthetic data, but they actually proved that the synthetic data is equivalent, like there was no difference between the real world data and the synthetic data. So that's a very interesting insight. Thank you for sharing that, Thomas.
I was thinking about that such a large organization with the very large number of employees, Thomas, possibly approaching maybe 100,000 employees. I'm just throwing out a guess there.
50,000. Yes, we are quite lean for a pharma company. You wouldn't imagine that.
But global. So, but Thomas Global, 50,000 employees and, you know, many different cultures and languages. Now we have this new thing, which is AI and very fast moving generative AI. So how do you win hearts and minds, or how do you influence or turn around such a big ship that you're now suddenly the captain of, or for steering towards AI? So any, you know, initiatives or ideas?
Particularly with AI literacy, I think Rohit wants to ask.
Like generally in that direction, yes.
So I have to say, first of all, it's actually easier these days than just a few years back. So that's, of course, a change of mind of the whole society. If you think about AI, just 5-10 years back, right, you had really to push ideas very hard to be adopted, for example, in medical setting. These days, sometimes you have the opposite problem, right? Again, that there's so much demand and that you can hardly fulfill it as in our AI group throughout Lilly. You were mentioning the global reach, and I think that's something that's very important at an organization like ours. So, for example, I have great teams in Bangalore, and now we also have teams in Hyderabad, in Ireland, all over the US, in many places in the world. And that also gives you very diverse ideas about AI, the user AI of AI across the world from very, very different societies. And that certainly makes our work much, much stronger, much more robust to all the changes that are actually happening in our society across the globe. So first of all, that helps a lot. Then second of all, we do a lot of internal education, of course, right? So at Tech at Lilly, everybody has to be actually certified in foundation courses in AI. We do advocacy and education for everyone at Lilly. There are a lot of resources, of course, we bring to bear. And then we have change champions for AI in all different parts of the organization who not only disseminate knowledge, but also get ideas back. And then with our central AI registry, we are collecting, again, this enormous wealth of ideas throughout the organization. And then we can pick and choose the ones which really drive us forward most and which will help the patients most at the end of the day. But of course, there is, since we are in a regulated setting globally, there are a lot of things you cannot easily change. You can run fast and break things and fail a lot, as we do in research, but you cannot do that when you are patient facing, of course, right? Mm-hmm. There you have to need, of course, quality systems at the highest possible quality you can imagine in AI, as well as, of course, in all these other spaces. And then, of course, regulatory requirements, not only from the FDA, but of course, the EMA in Europe or in South America or in Asia, in all different areas. And they all have their different AI regulations we have to take into account. So we have also have a large initiative on the legal and on the compliance side and the ethics and compliance side, how we handle AI throughout Lilly and throughout these applications. Mm-hmm.
So some of the projects that you see, what would be the typical time horizon? Because you said there's an AI registry and people bring you these ideas. So can you give us a little insight into that? Because you said you like to fail fast and, you know, try out the ideas. So what are some of the typical timelines for these projects?
Right. Of course, it depends, but that's a very good question. So we have a risk-based approach. So for example, if you do really an internal proof of concept on data that's not embargoed or so forth, or doesn't include PHI, you can be very fast, right? So we have often POCs that only take 2 weeks or so. Really, really amazingly fast. Yeah. Also something I was very surprised when I came in, how fast Lilly is moving compared to other areas. But then, of course, if you think about discovery, right, the development really of molecules, these are very difficult things. So that takes years. And you have to have the breadth to actually develop that and the AI for these models over many, many years. And that, of course, also needs expertise of computational biologists, for example, or computational chemists who use AI in that field for decades, the whole career. So we set up dedicated teams that really dive very deeply in these areas. These are not things you can just try out, right? You cannot throw all your electron microscope data in ChatGPT and hope that something comes out. These language models will never solve science on that level. There you really need this dedicated models, dedicated expertise, and work on that for years in these different areas. But it's worthwhile, of course, doing that difficult part, right? And it's also something I always tell startups. We get so many startups who think they're going to just try something with an API to a language model. They have a mock-up they did in 2 weeks, and then they're going to sell that to pharma. But every startup has to be aware, if it only took them 2 weeks, then our internal software AI team also only needs 2 weeks, right? 2 weeks. It's much, much more worthwhile and also rewarding to go after the really difficult things, the problems not everybody could just solve. Mm-hmm. And that's also the, of course, these are the most exciting areas.
To that point, Ritu, I'm chiming in here, just kind of sparked the thought around, you know, startups world and innovation in large business enterprises. And you've seen both, Thomas, you've kind of bridged the gap. Would love to hear a little bit more about your entrepreneurial journey, which kind of startups that you ventured out, and how do you feel different now in a large corporate environment doing innovation? And are the approaches different or similar, things like that?
Yeah, so I had my first startup with 16 in Austria in the 90s. That was clearly a very, very different world than Lily is now. So back then, actually, I coded a whole hypertext system without internet, just from books and magazines. Now that's very different to, of course, AI-supported coding we can do today. But of course, it teaches you a lot, right? And one thing that, of course, stays constant, you need at the end the customer who's actually interested and buys what you want. And it has to fit into the workflows you're developing to. So I think one of the most interesting startup I founded was called Page, Pathology Artificial Intelligence Guidance Engine. We spun it out 2017 from Sloan Kettering, and there we built very, very large models in pathology. So we digitized millions of slides. So you had billions of images, 10 times more pixels than the whole Netflix catalog. So all the movies you watch, all the shows, if you counted the pixels, that was only 10%. And with that, we built large frontier models in pathology. And that led to, for example, then models where we can do cancer classification in prostate cancer, breast cancer, and so forth. And that led to the first breakthrough designation of any AI in oncology from the FDA, and the first approval of an AI in pathology. And these models work really surprisingly nicely across the globe by now, so you can really generalize. But in practice, of course, you have a lot of hurdles in terms of reimbursement, and you have problems in terms of digitization. Even in the US, only 10% of the hospitals are actually digital in pathology. In all other 90% of hospitals, diagnostics is done like 150 years ago, like when Lilly was founded, at the same time when pathology was founded, and pathologists look through a microscope and guess something on a slide instead of actually having a quantitative readout. So there is this chasm between what we can do today in AI, for example, in diagnostics, and what patients actually get exposed to or have access to is enormous. As William Gibson said many years ago, right? The future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. And you see that constantly. And one reason of joining Lilly was that at Lilly, we have the enormous opportunity to reach millions of patients. So you can really impact at a much larger scale than you could before, right? And many of the drugs, of course, we are developing are terrible diseases like obesity that inflict probably a billion or more than a billion people globally. And to do something against that and help with AI is, of course, a fabulous thing. So the sheer scale is very different than, of course, back in the day. But of course, you have a large organization, and that's very different to a startup.
Tough job, I would say, Thomas.
Yeah, but extremely rewarding. We would like to ask Thomas for some, you know, closing comments, or where do you think the future is headed? What do you think the next three top trends are going to be, or for Lilly specifically, or AI specifically, and anything else you would like to share with our listeners? Thank you, Thomas.
That's, of course, really a difficult question, right? So no predicting the future is challenging. So, of course, a big area is the novel design of molecules. This is enormously challenging, but the speed of change there is dramatic. Although, of course, there's a lot of people who are very skeptic because we can't pump out new medicines with AI as we can pump out poems in language, right? Yeah. But the sheer scale at which we can now propose new molecules that are synthesizable, that have attractive properties, is a huge phase change to compare to what we could do just maybe 1 or 2 years ago, right? So you see enormous change there, and that will impact how fast we can develop drugs, but more importantly, if we can actually find the right drugs for interesting targets. Then when you start solving that problem, then of course the problem in development becomes bigger, right? So how can you actually prove out that these drugs work efficiently? And there it needs certainly to some degree a rethinking how we run trials effectively. Some of our submissions have 100,000 pages of documents to regulatory agencies. Nobody's going to read that, right? The agencies are going to use AI to read it, right? So yes. Wouldn't it be better to exchange data and to do that faster and get out drugs to patients faster, given they are safe and effective and equitable and really work for everyone? But if you can prove that, then we can hopefully increase the amount of medicines we can really deliver to the whole world, right? That's why there's, of course, also a push, for example, for small molecules. It's easier to ship a pill than an injector and so forth. So that democratizes also access to these medicines across the globe, which is drastically important. And to do that effectively, then we are again in manufacturing, you have to do that at scale very effectively.
Yes.
And that's a huge challenge. And that includes also not only the twins we talked about, but for example, robotics, not always humanoid robotics, but industrial robotics, autonomous mobility, for example, on the manufacturing floors, and again, across the world. So a very exciting area. And then, of course, a lot of education also for not only healthcare providers, but for patients in the world. And then hopefully at the end have better mechanisms to get the drugs also to patients. We should never forget that if you think about the extension of life expectancy over the last 100 years, 20 years of that expansion just came from better medicines.
Yes.
It is medicines that make our lives better for everyone. And that's a worthwhile goal to pursue. And doing that by writing code is just amazing.
Thank you, Thomas. Great closing thoughts. And I'm sure, you know, that leaves a lot for our listeners to think about.
Thank you to Thomas for such an engaging discussion. And we really appreciate it, Thomas. Hopefully, we'll be back again sometime in the near future to have discussions on yet another topic. Yeah.
Thank you for the invitation and for the very, very engaging conversation. It was fabulous.
Thank you.